Hi, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you all for coming. I'm Steve Morrison here at CSIS. We're about to get started. Please help yourself to some lunch if you haven't already. We're really thrilled today to be able to host Craig Kluwer from the International AIDS Society. Jennifer is Kate's, my colleague and close friend and partner in putting this together from Kaiser Family Foundation. We'll be doing the introductions and moderating the discussions here this afternoon. Part of the impetus for this, for trying to get Craig to come and be with us and talk today was the ongoing work that we began back in the fall looking at the inadmissibility approach by the U.S. for persons living with HIV. It resulted in a paper that we issued a short while back. Many of you helped us with the preparation of that paper. Part of that paper was inspired by many of us reflecting on Toronto, the most recent gathering that IAS has engineered, and lamenting the fact that in terms of U.S. leadership and impact on U.S. opinion and the like, it's been since 1990 that there's been any gathering of that kind on American soil, and it's a direct consequence of this policy. So we were keen to seek Craig's guidance and thinking on how IAS looks at these kind of issues and what are the standards and benchmarks and what would be required really to try and align U.S. approaches with broader standards that would make it possible to move in that direction. We're also very interested, simply as a matter of the task force, the CSIS Task Force on HIV/AIDS, in trying to raise the profile of IAS itself and learn more about IAS. And it's an important institution. It's making many efforts to strengthen its own secretariat and its voice and its capacities, and we want to learn more about that and be supportive as we can. Before I turn to Jennifer, I want to just, as a matter of advertisement, draw to your attention two things that are going to happen next week that are relevant. May 1, and over lunch hour, this will be down at Kaiser. Kaiser's kindly allowed us to host an event in their Barbara Jordan Conference Center. We will be looking at the debate around polio and is eradication actually feasible and achievable. We'll have Undersecretary Paula Dobriansky, Julie Gerberding, the head of CDC, Kent Hill from USAID speaking. We'll have a number of other discussants there. This is an interesting and ongoing debate. That's 12 to 2 on May 1 down at Kaiser. The second thing I want to draw to your attention is on May 3rd, from 9 to 11, up in the Capitol Hill, we're going to have an event that focuses, the task force event that focuses on the question of reauthorization of PEPFAR. We're working on the clarification of the venue, the actual space, whether it will be in the Senate or House side. We will be communicating that determination probably by the end of tomorrow or sometime on Monday. The layout of this is, the intention is really to raise the discussion around why the reauthorization process is so important and what will be needed by Congress in terms of leadership in order to make it an effective and successful process. Senator Feingold will speak at 9:15. Our doors will be open at 8:30 for coffee and registration. Senator Feingold will speak at 9:15. We will have representatives of the IOM, the Institute of Medicine team that just completed its review of PEPFAR. We'll have Helen Smits, the vice chair of that effort, Stefan Bertozzi, and Mike Merson there to speak. We'll have a number of other key Senate and House figures weighing in. The event will run from 9 to 11. Helene Gale will moderate. I'll do some introductory remarks. So please put that in your schedule if you can and get back to us, or make sure we know how to make sure that you're in the communication link as we firm up the venue and speaker list. So please come and do that. Jen, would you like to take over here?
Sure. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jen Cates from the Kaiser Family Foundation, and I'm very pleased to be co-hosting this discussion with CSIS and the task force. We've been working with the task force since its inception and have been partnering on efforts like this, both analysis and discussions that allow the larger community in D.C. to have these kinds of meetings and meet people from who are visiting from other places. And also, Kaiser has had a longstanding partnership with the International AIDS Society. We have actually a formal partnership with the IAS as the official webcaster for the big international conferences, the biennial one that we're all familiar with, and then the one that happens in the other year every summer that we'll hear about. And we do that so that we can help extend the reach of that conference, and we know how important IAS is. And to that end, we're very, very excited to be able to host this discussion with Craig here today. Craig is the executive director of the IAS and has been a longstanding AIDS advocate, policy analyst, working in many different capacities on HIV, served on as part of the 3x5 WHO antiretroviral treatment access expansion effort, planning and design of that effort, is a Canadian as well, so we want to highlight that. I think that, you know, for us, we've worked with IAS for a long time, but we weren't sure if everyone in D.C. understands what all of the things that IAS does. I mean, we're most familiar with the International AIDS conferences, and those are an incredible feat. To have almost 30,000 people come to Toronto from around the world, all focused on HIV from different perspectives, is an amazing accomplishment, and we owe thanks to IAS for that accomplishment. IAS also is a leading scientific voice for all of us working on HIV. It is a membership organization and does a lot of work on coalition building, on policy issues, and is increasingly becoming an important voice on international policy issues that affect people with HIV. So we thought it would be helpful to hear from Craig not just about what IAS is and what it's becoming, because he's bringing it forward in lots of different ways, but also what other kinds of things, in addition to the conferences, IAS is engaged in. A very important journal that some of us look forward to reading very, you know, when it comes out. Lots of other global internet forums and other things. So, without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Craig, who will tell us about IAS, and thank him for being with us.
Thank you very much, Jen, and thank you, Stephen. It's a real pleasure to be here, and thanks, CSIS, for hosting this event. I asked Jen to mention that I was Canadian more because I wanted you all to forgive my ignorance of the complex machinations and complex maneuverings of the U.S. political system, which when we talk about inadmissibility legislation, I sometimes get extremely confused about the workings of this phenomenal political system you have in the U.S. Versus the parliamentary system.
We're all confused.
So I just wanted to kick off by talking a little bit about what is the IAS. As Jen mentioned, we are a membership association of HIV professionals, people working professionally in HIV. Predominantly, about 50% of our membership are working in clinical areas of HIV, either as doctors, nurses. But we also have an increasing number of members who are policy experts and other individuals working in various capacities in HIV throughout the world. We have now close to 11,000 members in 171 countries, which is about double our membership from a couple of years ago. We've been through a huge amount of change in the last couple of years. IAS has existed since 1988. We, in fact, were set up, like many professional bodies, because of the International AIDS Conference, to be the body of experts that made decisions about where the conference would be, how it would be run, back in the early days when it was a small scientific meeting. Up until a couple of years ago, the International AIDS Conference was primarily organized in the local city where the conference would happen. by a set of temporary staff. So it was really thought of as an event in and of itself that would be recreated every couple of years that wasn't really tied in to other global efforts in the response to HIV and AIDS. So the change over the last couple of years has involved both the relocation of the organization from Stockholm to Geneva to position us more closely to some of our key international partners, UNAIDS, WHO, the Global Fund, some of the other large professional associations like the International Council of Nurses. Many of these organizations are based in Geneva, and so are we now. But more importantly than the relocation has been the reorganization of the IAS, so that we've gone from a small secretariat of 2 to 3 people to a medium-sized secretariat of 40 staff, with about two-thirds of those staff working on conference organizing and follow-up to the conference, tracking the commitments that were made, reporting on changes that have taken place from one conference to the next, and linking on a regular basis to our partners that are involved in the planning of the conference and in the overall response. And about a third of our work now, a third of our staff, an increasing number of our of staff and our work is focused on policy and advocacy, education, and information exchange for our members throughout the world. And I think it was a smart decision on the part of my board to initiate these changes. The role of an independent association of people working on the ground, delivering services or doing research in HIV, I think is critical and is an important complementary entity to organizations like UNAIDS and WHO that are primarily accountable to governments. What do we do in addition to we organize the International AIDS Conference. We're considered the lead custodian for that conference. We work in partnership with a few international and some local organizations each time. UNAIDS, who's in the audience, is one of our key co-organizers for the international conference, along with a number of civil society groups. And as Jen mentioned, Kaiser Family Foundation is our partner that we work with to increase the visibility of the conference throughout the world through more and more webcasting, ability for people to participate via the internet, because we know that 20-odd thousand, close to 30,000 people is about as big as this conference can get physically. So whilst we don't want the conference to get any bigger physically, we want it to get bigger in terms of the number of the people that can participate virtually throughout the world. I'm going to focus the rest of my comments this afternoon on the conference and focus in particular on the impact of the conference in terms of policy and advocacy. For people who aren't so familiar with it, the conference, it began as a small scientific meeting and is now the world's largest, most comprehensive conference on HIV issues. In fact, it's the world's largest regular conference on any health or development issue. It brings together science, community, and leadership. At Toronto, the most recent conference, had close to 25,000 people participating, plus an additional few thousand volunteers and staff. Just a little bit of history. The first conference took place in 1985 in Atlanta. It was, as I mentioned, a small scientific meeting, and it's grown over the two decades since into the multi-stakeholder platform that it is in the HIV response. The last time the conference was held in the U.S. was in 1990 in San Francisco, and in 1992, at relatively short notice, the IAS moved the conference from Boston, where it was intended to take place, to Amsterdam in response to inadmissibility policy in the U.S., which the next year was signed into law, preventing people living with HIV and AIDS from entering the country, either as short-term visitors or as immigrants. Since then, the conference has not been held in the U.S. The next conference will take place in 2008, August 3rd to 8th, in Mexico City. So interestingly, in the last couple of years and in the next year, we've managed to hold the conference all around the United States, but not in the U.S. So now to talk about the impact, but just the context before. I mean, we're not putting on conferences just for the sake of putting on conferences. And in the case of the International AIDS Conference being such a massive platform in terms of the media involvement, the participation of all stakeholders working in the response, and the general public in the city, in the country where it takes place, and around the world, and their participation. We have to think about the context. You know, I'm sure the statistics are all too familiar to you as they are to me, but it's worth highlighting them again. 25 years into the epidemic, 25 million dead, 40 million infected. These are numbers, but these are also real people, real human beings throughout the world that have been devastated both at an individual and a family level and also at a societal level in many countries by HIV and AIDS. The context of today, we've had 10 years of successful treatment for HIV and AIDS, treatment that is really, for many people who have access to the drugs, turning HIV infection into a manageable condition, albeit a potentially life-threatening condition if they develop resistance to the drugs or the drugs don't work. But for many, many, many people who have access to the drugs, they can count on living normal lifespans, working and contributing productively to society in ways that they simply weren't able to before combination antiretroviral therapy came about. Increasingly, there is access to treatment throughout the world, but new infections outpace our attempt to deliver treatment. And unless we can become more successful with our prevention interventions, then we will really never be able to keep up, even if treatment continues to be scaled up at the rate it is now or at a more accelerated rate. It's worth mentioning the economic impact. This is, I'm just going to sort of quickly mention this because it was for the first time in Toronto, the city of Toronto conducted an economic analysis. And the reason I mention the economic impact is because it allows us at the IAS, when we go into a country for the next conference, by gathering this kind of data, to really have more leverage with the city and with the government. So we know that Toronto generated a lot of revenue for the city, generated a lot of new jobs, generated tax revenues, and these are statistics that don't have any impact on the response to HIV, but do have an impact when we go in to negotiate with a country or a city where we hope to host a conference. But now I want to focus more on the policy and advocacy impact of the conference. And you can look at that in two ways. One is the impact of the planning stage of the conference. It takes us close to 2 years to plan an international AIDS conference after the announcement has been made and the early negotiations have taken place within the country and the city where the conference will happen. The committees are all put in place 18 months before the conference. And in fact, for Mexico, we next week will have the first joint program committee of community science and leadership meeting to begin to plan the content of the conference. But what happens in that 18 to 24 months in the host country, in its relations with the IAS and the co-organizers of the conference towards planning the event, is quite a remarkable policy and advocacy experience in itself. And then the five-day event itself, obviously, has an impact on the host country. And I'm going to focus on the impact on the host country with three examples, looking at AIDS 2006 in Toronto, the previous conference, AIDS 2004 in Bangkok, and the 2000 conference in Durban, South Africa, which was the first and so far only time that the conference has taken place on the African continent. I'm just going to give a few examples of some of the things that happened in each of the three cases to give you a flavor. For Toronto, in terms of changes that took place throughout the planning of the conference, probably the most important one that in terms of Canadian HIV policy was a permanent change to the visa application form for short-term visitors to Canada who require visas. Prior to about 6 months before the conference, people living with HIV and AIDS needed to disclose their HIV status when applying for a visa to attend Canada, to enter Canada. That didn't mean that it was an exclusionary factor the way it is in the U.S. People were still allowed to come in, but they were required to disclose. In the early stages of the planning for the conference, we recognized that the public health rationale for this rule really was out of whack with current knowledge on the epidemic. And we worked directly with the Canadian immigration officials through the federal government towards changing this requirement for disclosure in advance of the conference so that people who wanted to attend the conference would be able to do so, people living with HIV, without disclosing. And in fact, it took a long time. It wasn't an easy process. But in fact, the final result was much better than we had hoped for. We thought that maybe our second best resolution would be a short-term change. But in fact, we were able to achieve, working alongside the Canadian HIV community, both the community sector and the research community, we were able to achieve a permanent change so that visitors no longer are required to disclose their HIV status. Leading up to the conference, one of the controversial policy issues in Canada in HIV, as it is in many countries of the world, related to harm reduction approaches for injecting drug users. It has and is a safe injecting site in Vancouver, which is an experimental pilot site looking at people who inject drugs, given a safe injecting opportunity and the education and counseling and information that would be provided at such a facility, would benefit both in terms of not becoming infected with HIV or hepatitis C, or not further transmitting the virus to their sexual or drug-injecting partners, and or would come off their injecting habits and get onto either substitution therapy for opioids or stop injecting altogether. The safe injecting site was working quite well, but as you can imagine, a politically charged issue. And at the conference, just prior to the conference, it was announced that the safe injecting site would be closed. Canada, you may or may not know, had a new conservative government. There are two major parties in Canada, the Conservatives and the Liberal Party. About 6 months prior to the conference, the federal government changed from a Liberal government to a minority Conservative government. Just prior to the conference, the Conservatives were considering closing down the safe injecting site. There was so much activism and evidence presented at the conference that showed that the pilot site was working, that following the conference, the site was allowed to remain open initially for 16 months and continues to remain open. On the negative side, the absence of the Canadian Prime Minister, which really sent a negative signal to other political leaders throughout the world who declined their invitations at the last minute as a result of the Prime Minister's non-attendance, actually, conversely, re-energized the local research and civil society sectors working in HIV in Canada and have really re-energized their commitment to HIV and AIDS. The national activist group in Canada, which is called AIDS Action Now, more or less the same as ACT UP, which had become dormant in the last few years, is now active again. Membership is growing. So advocacy activism within Canada on HIV and AIDS issues has really been galvanized and re-energized because of the conference. Just quickly give you some examples from Bangkok, AIDS 2004. In terms of the planning stage of the conference, the 18 months beforehand, one of the important impacts, I think, was the creation of a number of pilot treatment centers in border countries from Thailand, which was actually created out of conference money. A few small, relatively small treatment centers in the hill tribes around Thailand, including in Burma, were set up. Those continue to exist today to provide treatment for people who really would probably be last in line in terms of their ability to access therapies. And I think that was a wonderful advocacy contribution of the co-organizers and the individuals participating in the planning of the Bangkok conference. We saw injecting drug use prevention and treatment programs intensified in Thailand as we headed towards the conference in the 18 months leading up to July 2004, harm reduction being implemented in a more comprehensive way. And I'm not saying that there aren't problems or there don't continue to be problems or that the conference solves everything, but I think we can really show some marked changes that took place as a result of the planning and then the event itself. There was so much attention paid to some of the criminal justice practices that were taking place in the few months prior to the conference, which included what many people believe were state-sanctioned murders of drug dealers in Thailand. Certainly the murders took place. Whether they were state-sanctioned or not, it's never been proved. But we saw, as a result of the attention paid to this issue at the conference, through the vast media coverage and the activism of those present, that those murders more or less stopped in the months after the conference, and as far as I know, as far as I've seen, haven't resumed. Again, that's not to say necessarily that there aren't still approaches to injecting drug use in Thailand and the region that aren't that are more criminal justice based and public health based, but I think it's safe to say that we did see a positive change. And then finally, looking at Durban, the first and only time so far the conference has taken place in Africa. You know, if you take your minds back, so much has changed in the last 7 years. It's just incredible in this epidemic. There's still so far to go, but if you look back to the year 2000, there was no access to treatment in developing countries. South Africa was still very much denying that the epidemic even existed. And, of course, there are still some concerns about denialism in South Africa. But in the period leading up to the 2000 conference, you saw the emergence of the Treatment Action Campaign, which is now a major force in HIV and AIDS policy development in South Africa. And, you know, evidence for that most recently, Treatment Action Campaign has been brought in by the government to design the next HIV and AIDS strategy. Before 2000, there were just a small number of people under Zaki Ahmed who had begun to work towards highlighting HIV/AIDS issues in South Africa, and particularly the possibility of treatment for the millions infected in that country. As a result of at Durban, you saw the sheer scope of the Treatment Action Campaign throughout the country massively intensify, so that it went from a sort of small cadre of committed activists to groups of activists working throughout the country, doing treatment education, doing advocacy, and increasingly providing direct prevention and treatment services to people living with HIV in South Africa. The theme of the conference in the year 2000, Break the Silence, I think was one of the most relevant themes ever of the conference. The marked change between 1999 and the year 2000 in the way people talked about HIV in South Africa, in the way the media covered HIV and AIDS issues in South Africa, was dramatic. And I think the conference really did break that silence. And just another example, we saw after 2000 to today, gradually dramatic price reductions in antiretrovirals that I think can be attributed to a whole number of factors, but the conference being one important one. And so now we head into the planning of Mexico. And, of course, no one can ever be too sure what the impact of hosting a conference will be until it happens. We know this is the first time the conference has taken place in the Latin American region, and I think that's a significant in itself. We know that the drivers of the epidemic in the Latin American region and in Mexico specifically are, as they are in the rest of the world, but in Mexico, Latin America, the predominant groups that are of people infected with HIV and AIDS, gay men and men who have sex with men, and sex workers. We're already, since the beginning of the planning of the conference a few months ago, as you know, the government has changed. It's still the same party, but new president and a lot of new leaders of various departments and ministries in Mexico. In the initial stages of that change, there were concerns in Mexico in the HIV community, the research and civil society sectors, that money for HIV and the tone of HIV prevention programming delivered by the government might change, might become more conservative. Mexico had one of the most progressive human rights and HIV campaigns ever last year, really under the direction of Dr. Jorge Saavedra, who runs the National AIDS Program there. There were concerns a few months ago that things might slide back to a more conservative stance. Because of that, there's been a lot of pushing back by the people involved in the conference, the local members of the committees, the international members of the committees, and we saw in the last month or so that the government has announced it will continue to maintain the commitment that it's shown in the last couple of years to HIV and AIDS, and the commitment that it has to making the conference a success. We can pretty much guess what issues will be highlighted in Mexico. As I mentioned, issues around homophobia and human rights generally. Recently, our last planning meeting in Mexico, there had been some rumblings from a number of HIV denialists in Mexico, claiming, for example, that the conference was just a masquerade for pharmaceutical interests, that antiretrovirals are poison, all of these old denialist issues that keep rearing their ugly head. So we hit that one head on. The conference co-organizers held a press conference about a month ago at our last meeting in Mexico, which generated a lot of public interest, public awareness, both in the conference and in HIV and AIDS generally. And we haven't heard anything since from the Mexican denialists, so I'm sure they'll be back. Finally, how am I doing for time here? Finally, I just wanted to focus back in on the issue of the United States and the inadmissibility legislation currently in place. CSIS, as I'm sure you all know, recently released a fantastic document that outlines the specifics of current legislation, the history of how that legislation was put into place, and discusses the recent announcement, encouraging announcement from President Bush on December 1st of last year, that the executive branch of the U.S. government would do its best to circumvent the legislation to enable people living with HIV and AIDS to enter the U.S. at least in the for short-term stays, for visitor stays, through what's been called a categorical waiver. We've all been waiting expectantly to see what how this announcement would pan out, and over the last few months, very little information has been forthcoming. We know that those in the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator within the executive branch of the government have been working quite feverishly to make this commitment happen. Concern of the IAS and a number of other organizations in the U.S. and internationally is whether this categorical waiver, which we presume would enable all people living with HIV and AIDS to enter the U.S. for short-term stays, which would be a major change, but whether that categorical waiver would necessitate individuals disclosing their status in order to be able to enter. And we're relatively certain at this point that it would. And certainly for the International AIDS Society, at this point, our feeling is that really would not go far enough in terms of enabling us to make a decision to host the conference in the United States, which we would absolutely like to make happen. I want to be absolutely clear that 17 years without having an international AIDS conference in the United States, the country that has shown the greatest global leadership in HIV and AIDS, certainly in the last 5 years, has certainly pumped more money than any other developed country into trying to deal with this epidemic, at least internationally, and recognizing that there are an enormous number of domestic issues that still need to be addressed in the U.S. and that I think require more intensified resources as well. We think it would be absolutely critical to have the conference here. The impact, not just on U.S. policy, but on global policy, could be enormous of hosting the conference, not just in the U.S., but in fact in this city, Washington, D.C. But our concern at the moment is whether the perspective, the changes relating to President Bush's announcement in December would go far enough in order to enable people living with HIV to attend the conference without undue discrimination. And disclosure in some countries, in all countries, runs the risk of stigma and discrimination. In some countries, runs a much greater risk of serious harm to the individual. So what are the other alternatives? Well, the other alternative is to change the legislation itself. And I know that a number of groups in the U.S. are working to make that happen. We certainly support those efforts and put ourselves out there to help in any way we can. The law is outdated. It was always wrong. It comes from a time where there was even greater fear within this country and throughout the world of HIV itself and of people living with HIV. It needs to be changed. It should be changed. And the conference should happen here. So I think I'll just finish there and maybe we can open up the discussion and take some questions. Thank you.
Oh,
I'm not finished. Before I end, I wanted to show you, because, you know, listening to me is just one way of getting a flavor for the powerful impact this conference has on people who attend and people who watch. I have a very short 3-minute video from Toronto, which really shows the power this conference can have on the participants and on the people that watch it.
So it is time for us to assure that promises made are promises kept. We must demand action over rhetoric and evidence over ideology. It is time to deliver.
It is with great pride that I now declare the 16th International AIDS Conference officially open. Merci beaucoup.
Women's rights are human rights.
We have to end this disease now. We have to get the drugs to the people who need them. We have to put the funding that's needed into ending AIDS now.
I want you to let the world hear loud and clear that women and girls will no longer be silenced in this pandemic.
We need more political leadership. We need the willingness of leaders to be outspoken on HIV as a leading issue of the day.
HIV has increasingly become a black and brown disease, abroad and domestically.
We have lost an incalculable number of lives which should never have been lost. That's a matter of excruciating pain and unconscionable political neglect about which historians will one day write.
This is a story that will have a happy ending because of the energy of the people at this event.
This epidemic is 100% preventable.
People will walk away saying that they really did take something home, not only people in the developed world, but also people in the developing world that they can take and use in their own countries.
I just want everybody, especially parents, talk to your children. That's the most important thing, I think, when dealing with HIV/AIDS, is communication. Because without that, kids were going to be left in the dark.
There's just been so much loss and so much of it unnecessary. Thinking about people I knew and people I've worked with, and it's just sad.
Ending AIDS will not be the success of one great scientist, one great community leader, or one great leader. It will be an accomplishment of a whole human family working together for one another.
I light this candle on behalf of all of us who are living with HIV and AIDS.
Karen Cup, Renee Highway,
Doug Wilson, Lim Patient.
Thank you very much.
Craig, thank you very much, too. That was very moving to have that at the end, and I kind of lost sight of what I was going to say, which actually was also thank you about the way that you talked about three conferences in particular and the impact that they had, because for a lot of us maybe who've been to the conferences and go and then come back, we see the impact from different perspectives. So it's really helpful to see how it has these lasting roles in different countries and regions that are incredibly powerful. So thank you. And I think what we like to do now, since we're a nice size group, is open up for discussion to pick up on some of the things that Craig talked about. I also know that in addition to the issues that that he specifically spoke to, IAS has also come out with various statements on new data on male circumcision, on what's going on in Gambia with different comments about cures and other things. So the IAS is playing a very important role in the international HIV discussion. So I think all of those things should just be open for discussion today. And please identify yourself when you do ask a question, just so we know who's here. Would anyone like to start?
Christine Lubinsky, HIV Medicine Association. I was just curious about whether IAS had formally communicated with the administration that a waiver policy that would still require HIV disclosure for short-term visitors would not be acceptable in the sense of triggering a movement for IAS to schedule the conference here. Because as far as anyone can tell, I mean, these regulations are still underway. So I guess I was thinking maybe that perspective could influence the decisions made about disclosure positively, and whether you've written to the State Department or the President about that.
Yes, we had in-person meetings about that right up until this trip, the last couple of days. You know, it seems to me like it's a question of will at this point. At least that's my understanding from speaking with the people within the administration who are truly trying to drive the change, the categorical waiver. Certainly my understanding that their desire over the last few months was to be able to do this without disclosure, and that the issue is the legislation itself and the lack of flexibility it allows for the executive branch to get around it. So, you know, my sense of my most recent meeting was of great disappointment at the way things look currently. Everything's in the hands of the lawyers, of course. So yes, we have communicated that. You know, at this point, that wouldn't be enough. So we remain eternally hopeful and optimistic.
Go ahead.
Peg.
Yeah.
Just say who you are.
Oh, sorry. Peg Williams.
the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. And I wanted to ask, I think there's been a perception, or maybe it's just a canard, that what started out as a scientific conference became more of a policy and advocacy conference. But it sounds like you all, by having the pathogenesis conference in the off years, would say maybe, you know, we address everything. Or do you have any thoughts on how to defend the conference from those kind of doubters? Thanks.
You know, we think it's incredible. The way that the international conference has changed wasn't a conscious choice by any group. I think that the way it changed, the way it evolved, was very positive in the end. But there wasn't a conscious plan. Science is really important at the International AIDS Conference. But more so, I think, in terms of linking what's happening in science to what's happening in policymaking and government, to what's happening on the ground in communities working to prevent and treat HIV. That's what's critical about the international conference, is that dialogue, that communication between all of the groups engaged in HIV, people with power and influence, scientific leadership and community leadership. It has been a challenge to maintain the quality of science at the conference and to maintain the interest of scientists in presenting and attending the conference. I think we did a pretty good job in Toronto of upping that bar from where it was perhaps in Bangkok. But it's a continual challenge to encourage scientific leaders to remain engaged in the conference. And there are certainly many that do and that see that value, and others not so much. There's also, I think, that a need for a science-focused meeting that links basic clinical and prevention science. And that's why we created the Pathogenesis Treatment and Prevention Conference that takes place in the off years, also biannually, and will take place this year, July 22nd to 25th, in Sydney, Australia. The first time, actually, that an international meeting has been held in Australia in HIV and AIDS, and given the leadership Australia has shown in HIV research, I think it's high time that the rest of the world traveled the 30 long hours it takes me every time I go to a planning meeting to attend that conference. So I think there's a role for both.
I would just add, one of the things I often say as well is part of the evolution has reflected the change in the way knowledge is shared anyway. And in the scientific realm, the conference used to be the only place where knowledge, we didn't have the internet and the same level of access to it. And so now a new study comes out and we all have access to it immediately. And so the urgency of bringing everyone together to have the scientific discoveries discussed has shifted a little bit. So. We over here? Yes. All right. I can't see who is. Yes.
Hi, I'm Kyle Kenner from CareUS. I wonder if you could tell us a little more about the Canadian process. As I understand it, they had a disclosure requirement, but they changed it in the advance to the conference. Did you cite the conference contingent on their willingness to make that change? And what was the process of negotiation that led to that change?
It was a fascinating process. We had already committed to, our rules are that, our policy is that we won't host the conference in any country where people with HIV can't attend. It was, so the discovery of this requirement on the visa application form was unfortunately made after the decision to host, because technically speaking, there are no restrictions on people entering the country, entering Canada. There weren't before, there aren't now. There's no policy whatsoever to exclude people entering Canada as short-term visitors. This question on the form was discovered a little bit late in the game. It was 18 months before the conference. So we started immediately, along with our partners, particular, I mean, I need to really give credit to the Canadian partners. One in particular, the Canadian HIV and AIDS Legal Network, which is a non-governmental organization that has is probably the world's leading human rights and ethical ethics organization working in HIV with a number of partners throughout the world. Canadian HIV and AIDS Legal Network was really instrumental in helping us drive forward the changes to the form. So in answer to your question, we had already made the decision to host the conference there. So we hadn't got to the point of considering whether to pull out. That was always a possibility. It certainly never came to that, because the Canadian government was very responsive immediately to the discussions that began to take place. The threat of pulling out was always there. But, you know, I have to give credit to the Canadian government. It would be wrong to interpret the results of this process as IAS and its partners, you know, came in and hammered the Canadian government into changing its rules. There were so many people within the government wanting to make this happen and pulling out all the stops to make this happen. And it was really those people in the federal government that made the change happen. And right from the beginning, that willingness was there. There was never this sense of, what do you mean? The form is right. People recognized immediately that there was no public health rationale for having a question on a visa application form about HIV. You know, active TB, yes. HIV, no. So it was fortunately something that was resolved within about, it took about 7 months, which is pretty fast, and was resolved in an incredibly collaborative way right from the beginning. So.
Thank you very much. In Toronto, there was a pre-conference.
Just say who
Pauline Muchina from UNAIDS. In Toronto, there was a pre-conference for religious organizations, and one of the major issues that arose from that was that religious organizations felt sidelined in the main conference. You know, there was no plenary on the role of religious organizations, and yet they play a critical role in almost every community around the world. So my question is, in Mexico, is there going to be a plenary on the role of religious organizations? And the second one, a lot of different panels addressed the issue of women and AIDS. And given the fact that gender inequality is one of the driving forces of the epidemic, I'm just wondering whether you're going to feature that more predominantly in Mexico than it was in Toronto. Thank you.
Well, you know, first of all, I think that women and girls featured incredibly powerfully throughout the Toronto conference, so I would have to disagree with you on that final comment. It's always a challenge. You know, the International AIDS Conference is a conference for everyone. And one of the most challenging things in my job and for the committees that plan the program is to try to incorporate the vast number of issues, the vast number of communities that are engaged in this response. So we're always trying to live up to and respond to criticism. So, for example, faith-based communities, as you quite rightly mentioned, I think in earlier years were very sidelined, were much more prominently represented at Toronto and certainly could be more represented in the future. So could a number of other issues. I think that children were the representation of issues related to children, whether they be treatment of children, which is scandalous, the number of children that are able to access treatments. It's scandalous, the few pediatric formulations that exist. It's scandalous, the number of orphans because of HIV and AIDS. So I think issues around children could receive a lot more prominence, and that's one area we'd like to work on. Trades unions say, well, you know, so many people working in trades unions throughout the world, trades unions are responding very powerfully to HIV. We need more attention to trades unions. You know, the global response to HIV and AIDS is so vast now, and that's fantastic. What we can do at a conference in 5 days is always going to be limited, but we are always working towards increasing representation, increasing attention to issues that are underrepresented. Youth, I think, was a great success in Toronto. Compared to Bangkok, there were double the number of young people participating. The youth program itself was incredibly exciting. I think there were close to 3,000 people, if I remember correctly, under the age of 26 who participated. And, you know, young people are the future in terms of the response to this epidemic. And when I'm dead and gone, it'll be the generation and the generation before that, generation after that will need to respond, because I unfortunately gave up hope a few years ago that I might live to see the end of this epidemic, and I know now that will not be true. So your specific question about a plenary on faith-based organizations, I can't answer that question. It's the program and organizing committees, of which I'm a member, that will decide what the plenary sessions will be, and those decisions don't happen for the plenaries themselves until November of this year. But it's possible.
He has his hand up for a long, and then we'll go to Steve.
Maurice Middleburg with the Global Health Council. I'd like to switch focus a little bit, please, and ask if you're yet prepared, if the IS is yet prepared as the leading scientific body to respond to the recent report of the Institute of Medicine on the PEPFAR implementation. Have you had a chance to review that, and do you yet have any comment on the recommendations in that report?
That one's a quick answer, no.
Okay.
Not as yet.
All right, thank you.
First of all, thank you very much. I hope the kind of presentation that you've made, you know, we should really think about ways in which, working with your schedule, we can sort of bring that presentation to other audiences, because I think it's very effective, and it will help dramatically in sort of raising the grasp of what's at stake and where IAS is going and how things might be made better. To push a little bit more on sort of how can IAS be helpful in informing the debate here in Washington, I would urge you to think about formulating a fairly concrete and specific set of recommendations and circulating those. And the folks that need to be touched are fairly obvious. I mean, the White House took a position in December which was the right position to take. It was limited in scope, but it was nonetheless an important opening of a debate. The fact that it stuck with the lawyers is an important fact, but is not the end of the day. And so there needs to, you know, every time that there's been progress, it's been a political choice made at the White House, at the highest levels of the White House. And we shouldn't rule out the fact that that option could be made under this administration or the next administration. So you should be, the fact that you have a renewed dialogue with OGAC, with Mark and others, is very promising and very positive. After a period of estrangement, this is a good move. You shouldn't be shy about carrying that forward. Congress, where the immigration, the specter of a divisive and polarized immigration debate may squelch opportunity, there again, I think it's a matter of being clever and figuring out how to frame up what needs to happen in a way that doesn't get lured into that trap, but creates some firewall or some kind of measure of protection so that people who want to act in good faith on both sides of the aisle can pick this up and feel like they're not going to be walking off a plank. Advocacy groups, the conscious, I think that this is an issue that somehow got buried or derailed from the debate here in the United States. You're helping bring that back. And I think the number of advocacy groups that can be more informed by this. Last thing I'd say is the presidential campaigns on both parties. If there's a concrete, specific, feasible, reasonable way of moving forward that will enhance U.S. leadership and enhance the support among the American people for higher engagement on HIV/AIDS, that's a winning argument. And it's something that campaigns are looking for, the kind of positive things that can be done, and getting people to pledge on record, we will fix this early on, is a very important thing. And it pushes back and gives cover on this White House to do things too. And I think if you were able to encapsulate in a clear fashion what IAS view is and communicate that to some of these target folks, it would be extremely positive. The other issue I wanted to ask you to comment on is just the one about the bizarre kind of way in which there's been this estrangement between the conference and U.S. official programs. I mean, you had PEPFAR booed repeatedly in Toronto. You've had high-level officials booed at some of the other ones. You've had a sense within this administration that there's no point in trying to get cabinet rank officials out on the stage. That, I think, is a terrible thing, and it's been hard to argue. Many of us have argued, get over it and move on. There's a lot to be gained. And you're missing an opportunity, and what happened 2 years ago or 4 years ago doesn't dictate what happens today. And some people like Mark Fauci and others have come and been very effective and patient and deliberative. But it would be worthwhile hearing from you. How do you get past that to sell the notion that it's terribly important for cabinet rank officials of whatever administration to take that stage and not simply rely on Bill Gates and Bill Clinton to sort of carry the water for the serving administration, which is a bizarre thing to think about when you look at it. Thanks.
First of all, I mean, I thank you very much for your set of recommendations on next steps. These are the areas that I think you hit them hit the nail on the head, and these are the areas that we definitely like to work on with you and with others, and probably clarifying our position in the short term, and just making that more widely known than perhaps it is. I guess we often make assumptions that things are known that aren't known. And certainly the presidential campaigns, as you know, John Kerry publicly came out before the last presidential campaign at the Bangkok conference with an announcement that he would reverse this inadmissibility policy. Sadly, somebody else won. Your next set of questions about participation of the administration or senior cabinet officials in the conference. Yeah, I mean, it's great that we're moving beyond a period where we couldn't even talk to one another, at least we didn't feel we were welcome into those discussions. The conference is a place where everybody has their say, from whatever political persuasion, whatever background, whatever community, and we really strive to make sure that every voice is heard. One of the changes we've made on our side in the last couple of years is to not, at Toronto was the place where, the first conference where these changes took place. Prior to that, we often had high-level people making speeches on their own without anyone else on the stage. And that was one of the things I think that that was a problem, because you put one person on the stage who has one particular point of view without an opposing view or a different view, then it can become, and people in the audience don't share that view, it can become a very tense and polarized situation that certainly as conference organizers we can't control without controlling the participation at the conference, which we would absolutely never do. So one of the changes that took place was always trying to ensure that on the stage you had different points of view expressed, that dissent for one or another country's policy or organization's policy, there was always an opportunity on the stage for that dissent to be voiced. And I think we did a pretty good job of that for Toronto. At the end of the day, some of the elements of HIV policy in the U.S. in the last few years have been quite polarizing. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to control that. You don't want to control that. You want people to have an open debate about that. But, you know, in the end, the officials need to make the decision whether they want to stand up and have their policies put under scrutiny or not. And I guess our experience in the last few years was that, for the most part, there hasn't been that willingness to participate at the conference. So there's always been some representation of the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. In Toronto and Bangkok, I think our friend here might want to add to that.
Yes, Peter Hartsock is my name. I'm with the National Institutes of Health, and I want to compliment the remarks made by Steve about getting high-level government officials there. We also have to get the federal scientists there, too. We've had every block put in our way as far as getting to the international AIDS conferences is becoming harder and harder and harder. Now, we fund huge amounts of the research that is presented at those conference, but when you have the actual feds who sponsor the research and who fight to get it funded, and then you have every block tossed in their way, this is something we have to deal with, and it's ironic. Because do you know where the World AIDS Conference was held the year before the last time it was held in this country?
Paris.
In 1989 in Canada. And it was regarded as so positive by the federal researchers that certain, rather than constraints made, Canada was in a sense for a couple of months regarded as part of the United States so that we didn't have to go through State Department clearance to get to the conference. And things have, so this business of what has passed could be prologue, but we have to get the federal researchers there too, because they're the ones who fight to get the work done. They get muzzled, and we have to end that. I'd also like to say that this past November is the 20th anniversary of the release of the Surgeon General's report on AIDS. I worked on that with Dr. Koop, and he and I talked about it, and it's been a trail of tears ever since.
You know, I'm really glad that you mentioned that. That are most people aware that after the Barcelona conference in 2002, Congress actually passed restrictions on the number of federal government employees that could attend any international conference.
Yes.
It was a result, whether on HIV or anything else, but it was a result of our conference and some of the negative events that took place at Barcelona. So since then, it's been very, very difficult for more than 50 people to attend. And in the planning for Toronto, we actually tried the tactic of working with the U.S. government of saying, well, couldn't this be a domestic meeting?
Yes.
It's only across the border, and it didn't work. So,
do you see enlisting the Mexican government actively in working with you on getting senior-level representation from the next administration in Washington? Do you see them inclined to help you on this? Because That could turn out to be terribly important, potentially.
It's an interesting question. We're thinking more broadly than U.S. senior representation. What was lacking in Toronto, as a couple of people alluded to, was senior-level political representation. Part of that was linked to the Prime Minister's decision not to attend. But I don't think we can blame it exclusively on Prime Minister Harper's decision not to attend. I think it was President Clinton in one of his talks who talked about the galaxy of celebrities at Toronto masking the lack of political leadership. So what we're working on for Mexico is international political leadership to attend, which would include the U.S. We've already engaged with the Minister of Health, and the invitation of the Mexican president has already gone out. So we're thinking if we're planning a year and a half to get President Calderon to play a leadership role, then that'll have a spillover effect on other political leaders. We haven't discussed specifically using the Mexican government's leverage to increase U.S. government participation, but it's a good idea.
Yeah. Why do you think there was such weak high-level political representation from the South?
Well, in addition to the Prime Minister's decision not to attend, one factor was that the UN General Assembly special session review took place in the June before. Now, there weren't very many heads of state at that either, but there were ministers of health and ministers of development represented. So a number of political leaders maybe felt that they'd done their AIDS thing in New York in June. That's one factor. Another factor that I think that's more worrying is that there just still continues to be fear. Because of the stigma and discrimination, there still continues to be a lot of fear on the part of political leadership to stand up and talk about HIV and AIDS in an honest and effective way. People are afraid of getting bad publicity. And there isn't enough pressure on them to do that yet. So, you know, we'll continue to play our part to do that. And the rest of the HIV community, the HIV response, will do that too. I know UNAIDS is, you know, as the UN organization accountable to governments, plays an incredibly powerful role in trying to make that happen, trying to increase political leadership. And it continues to be a big challenge. And I think that this is a disease about sex and drugs. And politicians don't want to talk about sex and drugs.
Thanks. I think we have time for two more questions, Ron, and then Sarah.
Thank you. Ronald Johnson from AIDS Action Council here in Washington, D.C. Looking ahead to the Mexico conference, I believe you mentioned that the role that unprotected male-to-male sex plays in the epidemic, at least in Latin America and the Caribbean region. And I was wondering if you could comment on the role that gay and bisexual men are playing in the planning of the Mexico conference, particularly in the context that many Latin American and Caribbean countries continue to be very conservative in their approaches to homosexuality.
We are everywhere. There are a number of gay men involved in all of the committees at every level, the organizing committee, coordinating committee, the three program committees, lesbians as well. I can't give you the numbers, but certainly significant proportion of the people engaged in planning the conference at all levels are gay men and lesbians.
Non-U.S.
and... Yeah, non-U.S., non-Canadian. I mean, if the issue you're getting at, I think what I'm hearing, the issue you're getting at is homophobia in developing countries, in the Caribbean in particular, you mentioned. Yeah, that's a big issue. And the number of people willing to come out, either as gay or lesbian, are fewer because of the fears of real, legitimate, violent responses to that. So, but yes, absolutely. It's going to feature human rights. I think I can't say what the theme of the conference in Mexico will be yet. It'll be, you know, these are decisions that are made by committee after lengthy discussions. But certainly human rights, I think, is going to focus in a very powerful way at Mexico, given where the conference is happening and what's going on in the epidemic in that region.
One more question, and then I think, you know, we're a small enough group that we might have a little bit of discussion after, but we will.
Okay. Hi, I'm Sarah Friedman from the Global Health Council. First, thanks so much for putting flesh and bones on what always felt to me at Toronto like being this big invisible daddy that was ever present. So it's nice to know that you're really there. I just, it's a real place, right? Little, now to, I don't know, maybe the invisibility, the illusion. I just wanted to comment a little on your last comment about the Southern leaders. I was at UNGAS about the fear aspect of it, not doing their duty, and I was totally stunned by how many leaders from Africa and the South got up there at that conference and actually uttered the words gay and lesbian, men who have sex with men, drug users over and over and over again, talking about what they must be doing and their rights. And I was totally floored by that. Whether it meant anything when they got home or not is probably another question. But they certainly were able or pushed into speaking that way when they were in New York. So there's maybe hope there. So.
I mean, you know, I think that's true, and yet the sad reality is that the statement that came out of the New York, the review meeting last June, didn't name any of the vulnerable communities that are, and that was because of pressure right. from a number of countries yeah. to not have that language. So you're right.
That
I mean, more political leaders are able to say the words than before, but you know, the fact that we could, they weren't able to agree that the world's governments weren't able to agree to name them in a document is depressing, to say the least.
Okay, well, we don't want to end on a completely depressing note.
Like, let's end on Big Daddy.
Yeah, big. We want some levity to our day. And I just, on behalf of Kaiser Family Foundation and CSCS, want to thank you, Craig, for taking the time to talk with us. We know that you're only here for a couple of days and have a lot of meetings, so this is very helpful. And I want to echo Steve's comment that this, giving this perspective on the role of IAS, which really, as a membership organization, is our organization, everyone here, and what IAS is trying to do, I think is quite helpful and information that we should think about more broadly getting out there. So thank you very much, and we really appreciate you sharing the information and looking forward to Mexico City with all of us.
Thank you both very much, and all of you.